Hey, Tacoma, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're going to be talking with Dr. Andrew Fountain, a scientist studying and teaching about glaciers here in the Northwest and around the world, including field research in Antarctica. He teaches and does research in the departments of geology and geography at Portland State. Glaciers can serve for us as laypersons as a canary in the coal mine regarding climate change. We don't have to be glaciologists to see the evidence of rapidly shrinking glaciers, not only here in the Northwest, but around the world. Dr. Fountain is going to be talking about the phenomenon as well as why we care what happens to our glaciers. So here we go. Dr. Andrew Fountain, welcome to Climate Talk.
Thanks. Well, thank you for the invitation.
Yep. So let's get right to it. First off, I'm wondering, how did you become interested in glaciers? And as you talk about that, I do have something else I'm just personally curious about. You're a professor of geology at Portland State. And is there such a thing as a glaciologist?
Yeah, that's what we call ourselves. But how do I say this? A glaciologist is a person who studies snow or ice in any form. So if you study sea ice, you're a glaciologist. If you study avalanches, you're a glaciologist. So it's not just glaciers.
Got it. So are there universities that have schools of glaciology?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, the University of Washington is one of the premier glaciological institutions in the world, if not the country. And that's housed primarily in geophysics. However, civil engineering and to some degree geology has major components of glaciological work as well.
So it sounds like glaciology is really quite interdisciplinary then.
Yes, that's right. You know, it started out actually in the discipline of geology because people are interested in the past ice ages and what geologic evidence had existed. But then over time, particularly since World War II, it's moved more and more into the geophysical, physical, and engineering disciplines.
Got it. Understood. So how did you personally, just getting to know you a bit here, how did you personally, your PhD is in geology, as I recall. So how did how did this interest in glaciers develop for you?
Do you want the long story or the short story? I'll give you the median story. How about that?
Okay, perfect.
So it actually started out as a kid. In junior high school, we had this guy. I was always interested in science, and we had this guy come to our junior high school to talk about his research in snowflake formation. And I became really interested in that. And believe it or not, there's a way to preserve the outline of a snowflake. And as a kid, I used to do that during the winters in upstate New York. And from that, I got interested in lake ice. And then because we used to do ice skating. And then in college, I did an independent study of lake ice, in the geology department. And suddenly the world of glaciological research opened up where I realized people actually get paid to do this kind of thing. So I started out in lake ice in college, went to sea ice actually in graduate school, went back to snowflakes, couldn't get a job in snowflakes, but could get a job in glaciers down in Tacoma doing weather kind of work. And then from there, I realized, oh, glaciers are pretty neat. I had never seen one before. Oh, they're pretty neat. I'll study that. But the thread through all this has been ice in some form or another. That's what's always been fascinating to me.
Got it. So clear up something for me. Is it really true that there are no two snowflakes that are exactly the same?
Oh, no, there's millions that are identical.
Okay. Well, this day's been a success for me just with that fact.
Oh, wait. But I don't want to take the romance out of it. There are some snow crystals, ice crystals, that are just hexagons, just plain hexagons. That's the atomic form of ice. So those are identical. But the snowflakes that you see in the sixth arm branches with all the lace on it and complex, maybe they're all individual. Why not?
Sure. Well, as a kind of a layperson interested in science, I would ask, well, how do you know that there are no two alike, since they're all over the place and nobody's looking?
That's right. But let's not think too much on that.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I'm ready to move on here. So you've been quoted as saying the culture of glaciology is unique among the sciences. And what led you to say that?
I don't remember that quote, but I don't disagree with it either. I think the difference is, first of all, there is not that many of us. And so we kind of know each other. And second of all, we spend a lot of time in the field under pretty difficult situations, just weather situations, sometimes, dangerous situations. So there's kind of a brotherhood, if you would, a sisterhood, whatever you want to call it, a community of people who kind of know the rigors of this discipline. And yet at the same time, we co-author with each other papers. We have to review each other's proposals. So it's not good to make enemies in this because it's too small. And it breeds a certain kind of person anyway that enters. So I think we're some of the more friendly kind of disciplines. We go to these meetings and we have we don't stay, sometimes we stay in hotels, but sometimes we stay in dormitories. So when you walk into the bathroom and you see there's some famous scientist there brushing his teeth in his boxer shorts, that there is a certain informality associated with that you might not get in some other discipline or profession.
Yeah, so thanks for that clarification. I'm just looking back at the quote, and it is about the culture of glaciology, not so much glaciology in itself. So you make that very clear. So let's start talking about glaciers and what can they tell us about climate?
Before you jump to that, let me just say that's a true story about going into the bathroom seeing a famous scientist in his boxer shorts. Okay. So glaciers are, let me define a glacier first, and that is a perennial accumulation of snow or ice that moves. So avalanches are not perennial, and lake ice doesn't move. So a glacier kind of squeezes in amongst those phenomena. So a glacier is fed by snow, and it loses mass by melting. So what controls snow accumulation? Precipitation and low temperatures. And what controls melting? Warm temperatures. So a lot of this is based on temperature, and to a secondary degree based on precipitation. So as those things vary over time, glaciers grow and shrink. And that's why they are really nice indicators of climate change. Also, unlike snow, which comes and goes, and you can have a good snow year, a bad snow year, a glacier, you actually go and visit and you can look at it and see how it's changed from previous years. So it's a visual record of past times that you can visually see, and from that get a sense of, well, is the climate warming or cooling or staying the same? So that's why they're good indicators.
So one of the things you talked about there, or maybe even the primary thing in terms of an indicator, is the extent of the glacier. And by the way, one of my earliest childhood memories, I lived in New Zealand as a child, and I visited the Franz Josef Glacier with my father. And so we're talking 1946, 47. And I went back there for the first time about 5 years ago, and I was really stunned how far we had to walk to get to the base of the glacier versus what it was when I left there. So there's the extent of the glacier, but there's also how much ice is in the glacier. Is that a means of getting some clues what's going on with the climate
as
well?
Yeah, and those two are related, the size of the glacier is related to the volume of the glacier, volume of ice. Not directly all the time, because you can have broad, thin glaciers or short, fat glaciers. But yeah, in general, they're related. And when you went to the Franz Josef, did they have the signposts of where the glacier was back in what year?
Yes. Yeah, they absolutely did. It was
yeah.
Stunning.
So, I think about, you know, whether glaciers are a canary in a coal mine. And that's kind of one way to think about it. Another way to think about it is they're kind of a, like a temperature gauge, particularly if like at the Franz Josef, they have those year markers of where the glacier was. And then you can, in a sense, see how the glacier, how the climate has warmed over time as the glacier has retreated. So it's kind of a, another way to think about it.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that historically, geological time, glaciers recede in advance. So is what's going on with the glaciers now different from that, let's call it the natural cycle of receding and advancing?
Yeah, that's a pertinent question. And a lot of the current glacial recession is due to anthropogenic climate warming. But there is a component, apparently, of natural warmth that... natural warming climate that is causing glaciers to retreat. And, you know, the challenge is to separate those two. How much is quote unquote natural? How much is human induced? And according to the, what they call attribution studies, and they use climate models to do this, roughly 2/3 of the current change in glaciers is due to anthropogenic climate warming. And 1/3 is natural. Now that's not written in stone. There are some investigations that suggest much more of our glacier change is due to anthropogenic climate warming over the last few centuries. But that's still very much a work in progress.
Yeah. So you're just touching on something there that interests me, because a lot of lay people, when scientific conclusions change, they say, well, where you go, there you go. Those guys don't know what they're talking about. They said A in this decade, and then they said B in the next decade. And so what you're pointing out there is that research continues all the time, and that conclusions are revised along the way. I mean, is that a fair way of encapsulating that?
Yes, yeah, that's right. And, you know, within this, the climate change business, you know, it's not a matter of yes or no. It's a matter of, well, are we warming 1 degree or 1.1 degree? You know, it's not whether we're warming or not. You know, I think a good case study of this is something we've all experienced immediately, and that's been COVID. You know, early on, they said, don't wear masks. You know, they don't really help. And then they changed their mind as the research progressed and said, oh, yeah, no, I'll wear masks. And then, of course, we have all the shots and the boosters and this and that. But if you notice, we've kind of settled down on a protocol that when COVID is present, we wear masks, we get booster shots. There isn't all that kind of uncertainty about what to do anymore.
Right.
And that's kind of the same way that's happened in the climate research business.
Yeah, so what that means to me is that willingness to adapt as experience is gained is a strength, not a weakness. And, you know, some like to point to it as a weakness, as they look, in the 70s, they were saying the Earth's cooling, and now they say it's heating, that
yep,
kind of thing.
Yep, that's right. In fact, there was kind of a famous, semi-famous quote or something that somebody said, oh, yeah, scientists thought the Earth was going into an ice age based on what was happening in the 1970s. And that's true in the sense that in mid last century, 50s through the early 70s, there was kind of a climate cooling, if not a equilibrium that wasn't warming. And glaciers actually, if not advanced, stopped retreating. And then somewhere somebody said, oh, scientists said that there was going to be a ice age coming. And that was actually traced back. And no scientist actually really ever said that.
Yeah, I've looked at that some myself, and there was chatter, let's call it, in the popular media, but not really any scientific statements to that extent, although that hasn't stopped people from claiming that there have
right.
been. So related to this, my understanding is that there are areas in Antarctica where the ice mass is actually increasing right now. Is that true?
You know, I should know more about that than I do, considering that I do work in Antarctica. But yeah, there are areas around the coast that are receiving a little more snowfall these days. And that's gaining some mass. And then there's, I think a lot of people like to point to the expansion of sea ice. But, you know, that's sea ice. That's not Antarctica. And sea ice is different. So I wouldn't hang my hat on that. And there's reasons for why the sea ice might be expanding and has nothing to do with climate change. But overall, you know, based on gravity measurements from satellites orbiting the Earth, as well as satellites that measure the speed of the ice, overall, the continent is losing ice mass. So yeah, there might be some areas that are gaining some snow, but you know, the big picture conclusion is that most of the continent is losing mass relatively dramatically.
Okay, understood. And one of the things that you touched on there that I think a lot of lay people don't understand is the incredible abilities we have at this stage to measure stuff. You mentioned measuring gravity with satellites. I mean, it seems almost miraculous to me as a layperson that you can do that. But I know there's all kinds of measurements that are being done from space and other measurement tools that come to hand. So I think lay people tend to just think about how they would measure, like they drill a hole down and see right. How deep it is or something like that. But there's a lot more going on.
Yeah, and you know, it's important to understand that there are independent ways actually of measuring these things, and particularly for Antarctica and for that matter, Greenland, there's gravity measurements. So that's one way, completely separate from these other satellites that measure the elevation and the speed of the ice. And from those two things, you can see if the ice is increasing in mass or decreasing in mass. And then there are models that predict surface mass change from accumulation and melt and submarine melting of these ice shelves. So you can have these on-the-ground physical measurements. So you have three entirely independent means all showing you more or less the same answer. Not exactly the same, but consistently a similar answer.
Yeah, that must really be rewarding when you see a measurement that you've been involved with get confirmed by some completely independent thing. So one of the things I'm curious about, my belief is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that Greenland ice mass is decreasing more rapidly than Antarctic ice mass. First of all, is that true? And if it is, why is that?
Yeah, it is true, and it's because because Greenland is being affected by warm air temperatures, which is causing surface melt as well as submarine melt as warm currents erode the glaciers that flow out into the ocean. Whereas much of Antarctica is quite cold, and there's not much melt except for on the Antarctic Peninsula, that part that goes up towards South America. Mm-hmm. And it's largely being eroded by warm submarine waters that are melting some of the ice mm-hmm. shelves and glaciers in parts of Antarctica, not all of Antarctica, but in parts of Antarctica. But let me say, look, there's three ways we get new water into the oceans from snow and ice: Greenland, Antarctica, and small alpine glaciers and ice caps like we have around here. Antarctica is huge, but doesn't melt that much. Greenland is kind of big and is melting more. These little glaciers, like Ice Study, are melting like crazy, and there's not many of them. But then when you do the comparisons, the amount of melt going into the ocean from each of these three categories is about the same. Hmm. So the little glaciers are affecting sea level rise about as much as Antarctica is right now.
Well, that is truly intriguing, given the size of Antarctica and how much ice is down there. So you've given me an entree to talk about the Pacific Northwest here. Full disclosure here, my office looks out over, well, towards the Olympic Mountains, and I've been in love with the Olympic Mountains since I first moved here in the late 60s. And I know that the glaciers are starting to disappear over there. They have been disappearing. So give a rundown on what's going on with the glaciers in the Olympics.
Well, there's about 250 glaciers and perennial snow fields in the Olympic Mountains. And we like to include perennial snow fields because they also provide water to high alpines.
Excuse me for interrupting, but can you distinguish between a glacier and a snowfield for us?
As I said previously, a glacier is perennial snow or ice that moves, and a perennial snowfield is just perennial snow or ice.
Gotcha. It doesn't move.
Yeah, and it's a scientific distinction, right, between the
okay.
two.
All right.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And from a lot of our analysis using remote imagery, meaning aerial photographs or satellite images. Sometimes it's hard to tell movement, so we tend to like to group those two together. It's kind of a more precise number. But anyway, this is kind of inside baseball. But so there's about 250 glaciers and perennial snowfields. And since about 1900, they've lost roughly half their area, of which most of that loss really has been since about 1980. So it's been relatively recently, the last 40 years, that the glaciers have receded a lot. And during that time, we've lost about 35 glaciers from that region.
So how do we gather the data that tells us this, that this is what's happening?
Well, you know, we can't hike to them all. That would take too long. So we use aerial photographs and satellite images taken over time, and then we measure the area or the perimeter of these glaciers in each one of these surveys, and then we can see what's happening to them. There are old photographs, handheld photographs that go back to almost 1900 that we can use in ways to kind of infer what the glaciers used to be back then. And through all of that, develop a picture of what's happening on the peninsula as a whole. The University of Washington has carried out glacier measurements on Blue Glacier off and on since the 1950s. So that's a relatively well-known glacier in that region. And just as an aside, that was one of the glaciers first identified during the International Geophysical Year in 1957, when they're doing these global measurements of the aurora and earthquakes and this to try to get a global synthesis of how the Earth is acting, what physical processes are linked. The Blue Glacier was one of the glaciers that they targeted for long-term study.
Yeah, I love those before and after photos. When I do public presentations, I use them fairly often because they are so dramatic and so easily understood by the layperson. They're really a wonderful tool. So how about Mount Rainier? We've got, I think, 14 or so glaciers up on Mount Rainier. How are they doing?
Depends on what glacier you want to talk about. Those glaciers on the south and west sides are really retreating a lot. And those kind of on the north and east sides are doing okay. It's not so much because of different climate on one side or the other. It's mostly because the glaciers, particularly on the east side, are covered in rock material. You know, the glacier, the mountain, yeah. The mountain is constantly shedding rocks onto these glaciers. And on the north side east side, for whatever reason, they're extensively covered in rock, which creates a nice insulating blanket for these glaciers. Mm. So they're not receding quite as rapidly as, say, the Nisqually is or Winthrop or other glaciers.
So that seems a little counterintuitive to me, because I would think that the rocks would absorb more heat from the sun than a white glacier would. So what's wrong with my intuition?
See, this is where science gets interesting, right? You know, you're not wrong. But the thing is, that's true if you have like a dirt layer that's about an inch or less thick, then it absorbs more solar radiation than it does insulate the ice. But then if you get over an inch, it has better insulating properties than heat transfer properties.
Okay, understood. That makes total sense. And it does point out that it's difficult on something as complex as this subject to have simple answers. There's just so much nuance and so much detail that's required to develop a clear understanding of what's actually going on. And of course, that's beyond the grasp of laypersons. And so that sort of opens the door for misinformation and denial and things like that. And I guess that's just the way it goes. So what would you say is the importance? What is the significance of the loss of these glaciers that we're seeing to us as people who live in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, aside from the aesthetic value that we like seeing these glaciers, like you like seeing the glaciers from your window, and those of us who like to hike to these watersheds and seeing this gorgeous blue ice, these glaciers are water reservoirs. They're frozen reservoirs of water that once the snow has melted away from the landscape, and made its contribution to our summer stream flow. What do you have left? We still have lots of August left, and we still have lots of September left. The only thing that's supplying water are melting glaciers. So they buffer high alpine streams from drought because they are the sources of water. Now, sure, when glaciers retreat, they might be pumping out more water than they would normally, feeding the streams, which is great, but the reservoir is losing its capacity as it's shrinking, and its right. ability to buffer the stream flow gets smaller and smaller with time. So we're looking at kind of these hydrological impacts in these high alpine basins. Having said that, people like to think, oh, well, how does it affect people? Well, you know, these glaciers are really quite small, and they don't, in many areas, they don't affect people directly, but there are places they do affect people. One is on the north side of Mount Hood, where the melting glaciers supply meltwater for the apple and pear orchards, particularly, mm-hmm. again, in August and September. And according to our estimates, Seattle City Light receives roughly 7% of their late summer flow to the Ross Lake Dam or Ross Lake from melting glaciers. And should those disappear, Seattle City Light loses 7% of the runoff. Is that important? I don't know. You have to kind of ask them.
Yeah, well, it does seem like it probably would be. What about Tacoma? We use glacier melt for our water supply, I think, at least in part.
Oh, Tacoma City Light gets it from Nisqually. Is that what you're thinking?
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. I don't know. I think they used to. You know, the problem is these glaciers that supply melt directly are so clouded with sediment that it would be difficult right. for a turbine to operate. So it might be, maybe it goes into a lake or something, then into the turbine. I don't know. But that is something I should know better about, but I don't.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about is modeling. I think, once again, speaking as a layperson, we just don't understand modeling. So do you guys do modeling on what the future of specific glaciers are, or even just glaciers in general?
Yeah, you know, that is one of the problems. You know, we all know the planet is warming. We all know glaciers are receding. But how do we parse the effects of different kinds of processes that cause glaciers to retreat or the climate to warm? That's based on modeling, and that's kind of mysterious and kind of ephemeral. Yes, yeah. You just can't get your hand on it unless you're operating, you know, with these models a lot. So I've done some modeling looking at the glaciers of the Olympics, and this is where we used global climate model output. And then what we do is we use that output and we connect it to, we feed it into a glacier model and say, okay, the climate model says this is what's going to happen in the future. And then we have a physics-based glacier model that says, oh, well, if this is what the climate's going to be in the next 50 to 100 years, here's how the glacier is going to respond. And that's kind of how it's done.
Yeah, so it seems to me like that must take a lot of computing power to be able to do that.
For the global climate models, yeah, it does. But for the glacier model, not so much, because it's a fairly small area, and we don't need – we can use desktop computers for that. We don't have that many numbers to crunch.
Gotcha. Okay. So one of the things that you touched on there, well, let me ask you this first. You've been, let's say the scientific world has been modeling for quite some time now. So we have the opportunity to look back at previous models and determine how well they did. So what's your sense on modeling glaciers, how well we've done historically up to this point in terms of talking about the future?
Well, you know, the old models are surprisingly good, that they've done a pretty good job in predicting what kind of glacier recession there would be. And we're just getting better with that all the time. So scientifically, our confidence is increasing with these models.
Okay, so cool. So, and what I think what I'm just working at improving my own understanding of modeling here. So my belief is that a model takes some presuppositions and says, okay, if these are the conditions, then this is what the result is going to be, rather than just saying, well, in 10 years from now, there's going to be X amount of ice. Is that a fair understanding of what goes on?
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, I think what people have to understand is we just don't use these models to predict what's going on in the future. We use these models to understand what's going on with glaciers. So, for example, we come up with some preconceived notions, say that the glacier flows downhill by gravity. So we put that in, we make that into a model. It gets a little complex, but you make that in the model. Then you find out the glacier is flowing faster than you'd predict. Then it's, aha, we've missed something. There's some more physics in there that we don't understand. So then we do some investigations, and then we figure out, oh, this is what makes it slide a little faster. And what it is glaciers actually slide as well as deform. So then therefore we incorporate the idea of glaciers sliding along the bedrock in the model, and then the predictions of glacier flow become closer to what we measure in reality. So it's this constant observation, modeling, back to observation. Does it make sense? Yes, no, back. And it's this back and forth that these models become increasingly improved. So the excitement, frankly, is when they don't work. That's when we learn something.
Yeah. I was picking up the excitement piece, and I can just see that, I mean, for a lot of people, the joy of a light going on. So, wow, there's something here that I never thought about or suspected, and now we're on the track of it. It does seem like a really exciting thing. So we're getting close to the end. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, of course, the climate change, global warming is an extremely serious thing in my view, and I think in many people's view, and it's important for us to get it right. And I got to say that so far we're not. That I'll just say that that's my opinion. And so related to that, traditionally scientists have done science and let the politicians and the voters and so on decide what to do with the science. And I just want to ask you, do you think that remains a valid paradigm, or do you think it's time for scientists to become more active in the popular forums?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't really know the answer to that. You know, the problem is once you get into politics, then your credibility becomes quickly, you know, brought into question. Not that it's not already brought into question these days, as there's kind of an anti-science movement. That's kind of part of my answer. The other part of my answer is, at least speaking for me, not everybody, I make a bad politician because I kind of want to know what the truth is, and I try to tell the truth as I see it. And it's hard for me to kind of exaggerate something in a way to make it look bad for you. You know, it just is, it's not how I've been trained. So therefore, it's hard for me to be a politician.
Yep, I totally get that. I'm actually sharing that view with you. I mean, not that I was ever tempted to get into politics, but it's just not a forum that I could ever feel comfortable in. And so that's all history. So we are pretty much finished here, Dr. Fountain. I really appreciate the time. Anything that I haven't asked you about that you think you'd like to,
to add? I'd like to talk about what climate deniers like to point to when it comes to glaciers. So what they'll do is they'll say they'll agree that glaciers are retreating, and they'll say, well, it's not due to human induced climate. But then they'll point to a glacier and they'll say, oh, that glacier is advancing, therefore climate is not changing. Well, yeah, there's cases where there are some glaciers that are not retreating or maybe even advancing. But that's like one glacier out of 10,000. So the weight of it, it's like my 99-year-old grandfather smoked all his life and he lived. Does that mean smoking doesn't cause cancer? No, he got lucky. Yeah. Well, in terms of glaciers, there's reasons for this. Some people like to point to the Emmons Glacier on the east side of Rainier. That had been advancing. Well, that's been advancing because, again, this pile of rock fell off the side of the mountain back in the 60s, covered part of the glacier, insulating it from climate warming, and therefore it started to advance. these things are explainable, but you don't use the Emmons Glacier to say all the other glaciers, all the other 1,000 glaciers in the North Cascades are not retreating. You know, it's just one glacier with an unusual circumstance. So, I mean, there you go. I mean, the crater glacier in St. Helens, advancing 6 feet a year. But that glacier didn't exist in 1980. So it's formed a new kind of snow gauge in there that's accumulating all this snow, and rock is piling on top of it to insulate it. So, yeah, it's advancing, but not because climate's cooling, because of the weird situation posed by Mount St. Helens.
So once again, you're pointing to the nuance of things and the futility of just grabbing one factoid somewhere and drawing a conclusion from that rather than looking at the overall picture and continuing to revise what our beliefs or our understandings of the real world, the physical world are.
Yeah, and that's partly why I won't debate climate deniers, because it looks like one versus one. I forget the comedian, maybe it was Colbert, but somebody had like, well, if you really want to do this right, you should have 100 scientists who understand climate change versus one denier. That's more representative of the field, not one-on-one. That gives you a bias versus this apparent balanced discussion. So.
Yeah, and the 100-to-1 would be generous to the denier. I just recently saw a study that examining 14,000 published papers on climate change, and there were 23 out of that 14,000 that denied the whether human activity was affecting the climate.
Yep, that's right.
But I guess if all the facts are on our side, we don't mind giving them a little numbers advantage with 100-to-1. So, Dr. Fountain, I really appreciate you spending the time with me today. I've learned a lot. Our listeners have learned a lot listening to you. And thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the time talking with you. It was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. And that's why I'm doing this.
All right, you take care. Take care.
Thanks so much to Dr. Fountain for condensing his years of research into understandable perspectives for us as laypersons. And I'm going to take just a second here to grieve the continuing and accelerating loss of our Olympic Mountains glaciers, gone for our lifetimes and gone primarily due to our burning fossil fuels. And the losses are continuing out into the misty future. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out, a bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. So until we talk again, remember, always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.